Every time I sat down thinking about my topic and the title, I was surprised because my mind kept returning to thoughts of violence. Violence witnessed by children, violence inflicted on children, or even by children. The occurrence of violence by children is high enough that any case you hear about cannot be dismissed as a one-off event. One national organization I follow is dedicated to helping at-risk youth, and their newsletter and seminar content consistently address adolescent sexual violence. What it is, what may lead to it, therapeutic practices, etc. So the place focuses on abnormal behavior, as you can imagine. But in this day and age, behaviors have to be pretty extreme to be considered abnormal. We have a court system that sometimes goes over the bounds to protect the adults, don't know all the facts, so they can't make a decision because they might get in trouble. So we have a lot of children being raised in our midst that count, by psychological definition, as normal. And I say that because people do behaviors and you go, that's not normal. And we're not talking about that. We're talking about an actual, is a child behaving within the scope of that fancy bell curve that, well, yeah, but it's still normal. So we have a lot of variation. So what about these kids? You know, what about the children that seem to act out, the ones that are at the ends of those bell curves? Their behaviors, they range, they're broad. They seem to border on insensitive, some of them, unkind, or simply unaware of their surroundings or what they're doing is impacting the people around them. And we might expect this from your 3-year-old, of course. But when it's the 13-year-old or the 8-year-old or the 18-year-old, begin to wonder. I believe that children every day make harmful choices and do so mainly because as a culture, we have less well-defined roles in place for people. Current public figures, media messages, and personal complacency, to name a few things, lead to pushing the boundary of what my grandmother might have called just plain civility. Have we as a culture lowered our expectations of children and child rearing? And how the blazes does this tie in with Joseph, Jesus' father? So nobody today was alive 2,000 plus years ago. You know, we could probably accept that as a fact. So how do we know what happened 2,000 years ago? What can we find out? That was the time when the angel visited Joseph, probably very out of the blue, and informed him that his betrothed was pregnant and he wasn't the father. Ah, but it was okay. God was the father. It might be redundant to say it here, but he was also told that it was God's will. What we say and what we believe has a lot to do with what we're willing to do. Now, you may recall, we have a written history of this event. The 4 Gospels of the Bible share testimony and witness for these actions. What was said, where it was said, how it was done, what the new rules were. Yes, sorry. It's all written down right there in the New Testament. Oh, but is it? The New Testament focuses on the message, and rightly so. I mean, Testament is right in the title. It's a discussion, but not a study of what was going on at that time in the Holy Land, the Fertile Crescent, whatever you may call it. Folks writing it took for granted aspects of life that may not occur to us. You know, what was their reality and what was the lifestyle 2,000 years ago? Imagine yourself a small, probably insignificant in the big picture of things, carpenter in a very small town. Nazareth wasn't famous. Mary, well, hadn't given birth to the Messiah yet, so people probably had no clue where it was, except for those who lived there. It's just another village. So from the work of some anthropologists, I pulled together a picture of life in the village. They go and they study the stuff that's going on there, pay attention to the climate and things, and what people left behind. And the land was dry, rocky, hilly, dusty, not very arable, scrubland. Well, that leaves goats. Goats can eat scrub. Maybe some really, really hardy sheep. Farming, well, maybe, but that would be minor. It'd probably be only just to take care of your house. Trade? I mean, after all, Joseph was an artisan. What was he doing here? Well, maybe, but Nazareth was 60 miles away from the closest hub, Jerusalem. And I don't know about you, but my casual walk is 3 miles an hour. They probably didn't have the horses or the animals that pull the carts. Thank you. Yeah. They're pretty self-contained life. You know, who needs a prosperous community to succeed? Well, artisans, merchants, traders. So how did a person like Joseph become connected to a small village? Oh, now this is kind of the fun part, because this is where my thoughts kept going. Violence. It's mentioned, but people don't usually think about the political climate, except how it applies to Jesus and what happened to him. So even though it may not have been the height of the Roman Empire, the occupation was going rather well from a Roman leader's point of view. If your little agricultural community thrived, the empire would eventually get wind of it and help themselves. I mean, really, the regional overlord flaunts his Jewish ancestry to claim a connection to the people of the land, but panders to the Roman Empire's command. Nothing was sacred. A pretty good time for God to send in somebody sacred, don't you think? Oh, but wait, let's not get ahead of ourselves here. So back to that occupation thing, the occupying army situation. Dollars to donuts, I would strongly wager that pillaging, conscripting men into the army, and raping women was a way of life for the soldier. Press ganging the local sons into service and possibly bestowing more sons on the women may have been thought of not only as fun, but perhaps a right. I mean, hauled out to Roman gods knows where, forsaken nowhere. What sort of benefit packages do you think they were getting? So my point being is that Mary of Nazareth can by no means be the only young girl, nor the first person pregnant out of wedlock. I have faith that in a culture trying to survive, that no matter how angry we are at the crime, no matter the culture bent that makes the raped one at fault, at least in part, that I believe there is still a human sense of responsibility to tend to the injured. And so I believe there was, in the midst of a violent culture, a relatively speaking, compassionate system to tend to daughters and wives who were so treated. After all, with your sons gone to heaven's nowhere, it would take something pretty dire to drive you to exile your future baby makers as well. Who would be left to carry on your culture? So that's a slight segue. I put that information for me sets up for me, it was like the perfect time for a great communicator to be born. I mean, you really are dealing with folks who are having a hard life, and you want to create a good life. I mean, it's kind of like taking us and dropping us in the middle of a country where you don't speak the language and the food is different. I believe the groundwork was being laid so that Joseph was able to be a father to Jesus. There was this horrible lifestyle compared to what the privileges we have now. But that's about as many, probably more details than we really need to get into in the historical dreary part, for me to make my point. What this leads up to is that I realized after pulling all that together and thinking about it, that the title of this talk is actually quite inaccurate. But of course, it's made the rounds, we've advertised it, but the concept is the same. Because you know what? We know what Joseph did. He provided. In the face of no agreement, he provided. And regardless of your belief, your relationship to Jesus the Christ, there's no denying that alongside Mary, Joseph raised that kid. And not only did he help raise Jesus, something, big capital S, happened that empowered Jesus to become the great communicator. Sure, he had one step up. I mean, he's God's son. Which would be a really convenient step up for a lot of us. But the intention, as I believe it, on having Jesus come to earth was to experience humanity, to know the human experience, and be truly compassionate and understand the sacrifice that Jesus, or any man actually, don't have to be the Son of God, can make to save a race, an ideal, or whatever. Jesus had to get human experience from not God. In other words, humans. You know, what would be the point otherwise of having a baby born from a human, having it raised by humans? So not much is written about Joseph. He shows up out of necessity to make nice in a patriarchal culture about his wife carrying a baby, not his son, and that it was okay with Joseph. Why else bring him into the picture? Allegorically or literally, we need that reassurance that it's okay. Raise the child, any child. Make him great. So did you ever notice that even though Joseph shows up minimally, a significant point is made of his ancestry? So I love this part. Not even related by blood to Jesus. But Joseph was descended from King David, and that was important. I mean, besides conveniently getting the couples to Bethlehem for the census, if that's an important part of the great picture, I like to read this in two ways. My first one is when I'm feeling very selfish and self-indulgent. Of course he raised Jesus. He's from a line of leaders. That's what leaders do. So I like this one when I'm feeling kind of slimy. It just might get me off the hook when I don't want to do something uncomfortable or icky. I mean, after all, how do I know I'm descended from leaders if I have the strength to do what's right? If we actually looked at my personal family tree, we could see that I am descended from a long line of adoptive parents. So, you know, what does it mean? Or much more favorably, Joseph came from greatness, as do we all. If he can do it, we can do it. Now, back to the future, our future. What's happening today? What's the normal kid up to? Are they a product of a violent culture? A complacent culture? What? What the heck is going on? Do you remember Steubenville last summer? Wouldn't it be nice if the Steubenville, Ohio date rape tragedy, quick summary, male teens taking humiliating and sexual advantage of an inebriated female teen and then advertising it through social media, was a one-off event. Wouldn't that be really nice? We can't be so blind. You go back 20 years in the 1990s and think Glen Ridge, New Jersey. Again, date rape of a female incapable of making her own choices. Again, teenagers. So stunned was the nation at that time, sociologist and investigative reporter Bernard Lefkowitz invested 6 years investigating what happened and why these boys would even do this. These were football jocks. These were maybe not honor roll, but reasonable grades. These kids had great outlooks coming up at colleges. Lefkowitz found parents protecting their own children at all costs to the health of the victim, teen peers colluding to cover up what happened, teens shunning the one teen that exposed the crime. And this particular one also became racist. The one team that exposed the crime was the one black super jock on the football team in the community. And that card was played rather heavily in the 90s. Played rather heavily in that trial when it came to trial in the 90s. Acts of violence and implicit endorsement by complacency, shifting blame, etc., have occurred throughout history, you know, as much as we'd like it to not have happened. It's happened, and also close to home. Think back 3 summers ago about the terrible violence inflicted on 8-year-old Robert Manuel. He was a Boise, and that finally killed him. And this does perplex me that it happened. But what I really end up asking myself is, who were these people? What were their influences when they grew up? So in cases like these, the greater community often practices, whether intentional or not, a bit of complacency, ignoring signs that trouble is brewing. Oh, that can't have been what I saw. You know, we want to think the good of people. And when something horrible does happen, community involvement only comes often after the tragedy. You know, we want to talk about it. It's natural, and we should. We should talk about it. What to do next? How do we keep it from happening to one more child? Well, the number one response, which you will relate to being part of a spiritual congregation, is to donate money. We either feel like we have the money to donate, so we're going to put it somewhere. Where can we put it that it's going to work? Or we need that money to do something else, but what can I do otherwise? How does it's very funny that a money conversation comes in when we're talking about people and compassion. So where do we put our money? Maybe to the police? Defray the cost of this event. Bolster them for the next event. That's great. Our police department needs help. I also feel that sometimes when we do this, though, we're like almost expecting that next event to happen. We want to help those folks, but we want the next event to have a better ending. So great. Nonprofit shelters, yeah, keep donating. These people need support. Something rough's happened in their life. They need the support. But hey, let's look at reaching the root of these problems as well. Number two seems to be to investigate children's social services. After spending 7 years in Connecticut, where in the light of many tragic missteps, there was a constant hue and cry about how these services weren't doing their job, coupled with no movement forward, and they need training, blah, blah, let's take them to court. Oh, that takes money too. I have little personal faith in this solution. These people are in a field that, no matter their intentions, is limited by funding and other traditional resources. Who knows? Maybe social services are using a model that is no longer effective and needs transformation. That would take more money. See, number one. I think the problem lies in a perplexing how. As in, how do we raise funds, educate, create awareness, a ruckus, whatever. You know, just about anything. How do we create it? I share with you what's been happening because I want us to know that it's present. But I also want us to know that every time we come across a person who's been downtrodden, they still have a piece of human heart in them. Even the people, the perpetrators. Sometimes, instead of being able to say, I love you, I have to say, God loves you right now, because I can't do it. But I have faith that the answers are there. And for this presentation, I have one idea I'd like to share. Lift us a little bit out of the Derman string I just piled on you on your cheerful, bright, sunny summer Sunday morning. If we keep hearing, we didn't raise our kids to be this way, maybe we need to look at how we have been raising them and how we can torque that, twist it, shift it. Do we want it to go sour? Do we want it to lift up? Look to the future. Pull an old Bifana. What does that mean, to pull an old Bifana? Simply this. Be aware of your impact on the children around you. That's all. One step beyond is take yourself to unfamiliar places and be aware there. I don't know what's unfamiliar to you. The mall? Children's section in the library? Teen night somewhere. Intentionally go look at that calendar and go, look, they're all going to be 30 to 50 years younger than I am. I wonder what they do. And show up, and you might be surprised. Digging into my personal current research laboratory in early childhood development, read Vista Montessori, where I work. At my school, we can tell within a week what children get disempowering messages and which ones get empowering ones outside our classroom. Some children are easy. Some children are a handful. And all children, and you probably know some adults too, have magic moments when what I wish them to do has nothing to do with what they want to do. I am being constantly called to pull an old Defana and love each child as if they were the one, the next Messiah. I really don't know. We really can't know. Heck, there are days when at home with my children, my mantra runs, Logan's the Messiah, Logan's the Messiah, Logan's the Messiah, Logan's the Messiah, Logan's the Messiah. Logan is 7, by the way. Now, in light of that, take a look at how many neural connections are made in the little brains under the age of 3. 700 every second. Second. There's only one time in our life that we do that. Maria Montessori called the ages of 0 to 6 the period of the absorbent mind. Think about it. How else does a little package learn language and motor skills? They're taking it all in, these little sponges. The absorbent mind, indeed, what we say and do matters. Also, consider your typical adolescent. The teen brain is pretty much rewiring itself into adulthood. There are days when you can even see it happen on the face of your favorite adolescent right in front of you. And with all that rewiring happening right in front of us, I have no doubt what we say and do has an impact on adolescents' development. At home, here, on the street. Males may commit violence at a higher rate than females, so we may think our first step is to provide boys with good role models. Oh my gosh, and good experiences and bonding and how to create community and compassion, but wait. We also need to provide it to the girls. How else are they going to be able to recognize an unhealthy relationship if they don't have any healthy ones to compare them to? Friendships, romantic relationships, workplace relationships. I want them to be able to see that. I want our children to see that the loving and kind person can also be the auto mechanic. Macho and compassionate come in the same package. And power has nothing to do with violence. Peace begins with the example we set for the child. Now, I'm not saying change careers. Admittedly, I did do that at age 44. And I'm not saying change your personal focus. Admittedly, we do need research done. We need the science. We need people to do this work. So we need to know as a race if an abnormally small amygdala, which is that part of the brain that helps you realize what's right from wrong, can be nurtured in health in childhood so that that right and wrong trigger's working strong when you're in a situation you don't know what to do in. Heaven knows we need people working in therapy, rehab, mental services. But we also need people in all walks of life to impact children through what they believe personally. Take what you know from your work, your life. Be intentional. Take what you know to be a healthy model and model it yourself. How can you tell if you have a presence or an impact? And maybe you can't. You know, roll the dice. You really can't tell. Although, sometimes they do come up to tell you 5, 15 years later, that one moment made a difference in their life. So you bank early. Don't let it stop you that you can't tell. Start a conversation with an elementary age student. Comment positively on a teen's reading choice. Comment positively on anything that you see a teenager do. If you don't love working with kids, that's really fine. If you don't even like kids, that's fine. Be who you can be. Be your own ethical self. Your adult friends were kids once, so your input is valued. Be visible. Whatever that means to you. So how can a child know a person can make a difference if they don't know they're surrounded by people who do? So I've reached my last printed page for the day. Will there be a congregational commentary? Yes. It's called the coffee hour. I want people to work at this. Not like grueling, back-breaking, mind-bending work, but work with a capital W. Working flexes the muscles, not only to make you stronger, but to make it second nature, to make you strong so that when somebody asks you about what you do, it is clear as a bell. As the message reaches beyond you to somebody who just might be overhearing, just might be next to you and can't help see how cool you are. So get out into that coffee hour. Hold your own. Do the work of the world in your one-on-one commentary and conversations. Those conversations are what make it work. Enjoy what you do here at Booth today. But remember, you're going home soon. Will your passion for what passes here pause for a week or live within you daily? Maybe this week you'll pull an old Bafana. Finish baking the cookies, sweep and close the house, and pursue what you know is true.